You were in Brussels yesterday. Mm-hmm. The BBC says that there's a crisis with the Brussels package, this 20% by 2020. What's your reading on it?
I think I would say it's a sort of moment of truth for Europe in the next week, as to whether at this critical time for climate change, with new American leadership from President-elect Obama, and a very difficult economic situation, as to whether we can show that we're not going to back away from our commitments on climate change. And you know, my message to my fellow ministers yesterday was that the most important thing is that we have a package from Europe which is a package with environmental integrity, and I think most of all that means reaffirming the commitment to go from 20 to 30%, which was made at the heads of government meeting last year, subject to a deal at Copenhagen, because I think that's a very important signal to the rest of the world. And I know from talking to environment ministers from other developing countries that that's very important, that Europe holds to that commitment, and to a package that has wider environmental integrity. And also, and I think this is an important point, the other two things that I said are, one, we've got to show we can drive the low carbon economy of the future. That means investment in carbon capture and storage, and we are putting out all the stops to ensure that we have a proper European investment in CCS, and I hope very much that will be part of the eventual arrangement. And secondly, we've got to show that we understand the concerns about competitiveness, but we're going to maintain, as I say, the environmental integrity of the package. So, and I think that message is generally shared actually in the rest of Europe. But I think there are obviously difficult discussions ahead, you know, I hope very much we do get an agreement at what will be the end of next week.
Is there a serious chance that we won't?
I'm not experienced enough of these negotiations to know. I mean, I think that there are a lot of concerns around, partly prompted by the economic situation, which does make keeping to these commitments more difficult. But I think it is incredibly important that we do get an agreement. You see, when I think about Poznan, which also is next week, the backdrop to Poznan is at the moment, I think, a positive one because of what President-elect Obama has said, but it will be much more positive if we get an agreement in Europe, and much more negative if we don't. And you know, in a sense, all of these things really matter for the road to Copenhagen, because if Europe shows that it is serious and that it is within the IPCC range of 25 to 40% by 2020 for 2020 targets, you know, that is a very, very strong and positive signal that Europe is sending. So I hope very much we will hold fast to our commitments.
Could it make it very difficult for you to go to Copenhagen or the meetings next year if we don't get this, won't it? Because people like Japan and even the US are going to look to Europe.
Yeah, I think, look, I'll make no bones about it. If we don't get a new European agreement, people will question Europe's commitment on these issues, and will say, look, you know, you had at the most important moment, you shied away from an agreement. So that's why it's incredibly important that we get an agreement. And I'm very clear about that, as is the British, you know, everyone in the British government.
Yeah, okay.
Is an international deal possible without Europe?
No, I don't think so. I think Europe's got... Look, Europe is a very, very... 15% of emissions. Europe is a very, very important part of an international agreement. And, you know, I think there was... I don't remember whose slogan it was, but I will if you will. You know, that is the kind of mantra around climate change. And we've got to show that we will. And and if we don't, I think it will cause, you know, real problems. And look, I'm obviously... I keep these discussions confidential as to who I've spoken to about this, but it is a very clear message that I've got from other developing countries that, far from what some people might think, which is, well, the UK is only 2% of emissions, Europe's only 15% of emissions, does it really matter? You know, far from it, what the UK in particular and Europe in general does sends a big signal around the world. The fact that we committed to an 80% to 2050 target, the fact that we've got the Committee on Climate Change, the response we make to that next year, all of those things form the backdrop to what other people bring to the table. And, you know, climate change is the sort of kind of best possible example, you have what I think they technically call a collective action problem. You know, everyone has to come forward and be part of it in order to tackle the problem that we face. So you know, it's very important that Europe steps up to the plate.
So I mean, we'll move on from this in a moment. But just so does that mean, from what you said, if we don't get an agreement in Brussels next Friday, is the whole Copenhagen deal sunk before it's even begun?
I don't think I want to entertain the sort of possibility of failure. I mean, I think it's very important that we succeed, and that's what we're going all out to do.
Assuming that we do succeed then, and then we move on, and next year is a build-up to Copenhagen, what's the lie of the land at the moment as you see it? Particularly sort of the US-China axis that people have talked about.
I mean, as I say, I think there's very encouraging... it's very encouraging what we've seen from President-elect Obama in his address to the Governance Conference of California. Look, the way I think about it is this. What are the three elements you need for a deal at Copenhagen? It seems to me it's someone relatively new to this job. I think you need, first of all, developed country commitments, significant developed country commitments to both 2050 targets and interim targets. Secondly, you need developing country commitment to move away from business as usual in terms of emissions, particularly advanced developing countries. And thirdly, you need flows of finance from developed to developing countries, reliable flows of finance which can help finance adaptation and mitigation. They're the three things three parts to a deal. I think that, as I say, what we've seen from the US is very positive. I think there are strong signals from China that they understand the challenge that climate change poses to the world and indeed to them. And so, you know, I think that it's a very difficult time to be trying to agree to make this agreement in the coming year. And I think one shouldn't sort of pretend otherwise because of the economic backdrop. On the other hand, it's also an opportune time because of a new president in America who's shown his determination to tackle this issue. And also, you know, it's urgent that we do get an agreement. Mm. And so we have to go all out for it. The one other thing I would say, just to a long-winded answer, is that governments on their own can't achieve this. I'm absolutely convinced about this. You need a popular movement, and much more of a popular movement than you have so far. I've met the NGOs, the green NGOs, a couple of times, and the development NGOs once, and the message I've emphasised to them, and it may sound odd for a politician to be saying this to them, is we need more of an international movement on these issues. I think back to Make Poverty History, and you know, that was, in the run-up to Glen Eagles, a mass movement that... you know, was necessary to get the agreement that was got. And actually, in the issue of case of climate change, it's even more difficult, because the analogy I'd make is this, which is that in relation to development, I don't think there was a strong body of opinion that was opposed to getting an agreement. In relation to climate change, there are people who have concerns, some of them legitimate concerns, whether it's some businesses in Europe who worry about the effects on competitiveness, others who say, is it really necessary to do this now? Therefore, it's even more important that governments all around the world are pressured and supported in equal measure to reach an agreement. And I don't yet see, and I've said this openly to the NGOs, I don't yet see that movement there. Now, I think that is going to happen, and I think that's very important that it happens. I mean, let me just say three other things about what I think this movement needs to do. I think it needs to be ambitious, so it needs to be stretching in what it sets governments. I think that's part of the job of civil society. I think it needs to express the urgency. I think the other thing it needs to be is optimistic. And when I say optimistic, it needs to convince people that the change can happen, and that it can be a change that is consistent with growth, with economic growth and fairness. And I think that's really important about these issues, and it's something I've emphasised. You know, the Department of Energy and Climate Change means you need an energy policy that is sustainable, i.e. meets the obligations of the planet, but it also means you need a climate change policy that is fair. So, you know, I'm discussing in another part of the forest prepayment meters. Now, it made me think, well, what's the connection to this? The connection to this is, I don't think that the price of... I don't think that part of a successful climate change policy is making the poorest people in our society pay too much for their energy. In other words, you've got to have fairness to take people with you on climate change. And I think that, and the reason I mention that in relation to the movement is because I think it's really important that you convince people that climate, that tackling climate change can be part of an optimistic vision of society, of the kind of place you would want to live, a nicer place to live than place now in terms of, you know, I think about Doncaster, the area that I represent as an MP, you know, the idea that we'd have more parts of Doncaster where you could walk around as a pedestrian, for example, where you have better public transport. I think all those things have to be part of the vision on climate change. It can't just be a sort of technocratic argument about the science. The science is important, but you've also got to relate it to the way people live their lives.
Do you need this mass movement because there isn't the bedrock of support for politicians to take the difficult decisions?
No, but I think, I mean, what do I learn about politics? I think politics is, political change comes from two things. It comes from leadership and popular mobilisation, and you need both of them. Popular mobilisation on its own isn't necessarily enough if you don't have political support, but political leadership on its own isn't enough either. The fact that Friends of the Earth organised a campaign, someone was telling me that DEFRA had responded to 50,000 cards, I think, 50,000 letters about the 80%. Look, that has an effect. And I don't think that's something to be embarrassed about. I think that's the way political change happens. You know, when you think about the big historic movements, from the suffragettes to anti-apartheid to sexual equality in the 1960s, all the big political movements had popular mobilisation behind them. Politics isn't just about the elites, it's about people as well. So, you know, I think you need both of these things.